This is a Sound Rebel podcast.
Discover more of our shows at soundrebel.co.uk.
And it's Dwight York. He's brought down by Peruzzi. Cole to finish it off. Full speed ahead. Barcelona. Manchester United are in sights of a European Cup final again. Welcome to Triple Captain. We've got a very special guest coming on.
I don't think yours was as good as him doing it in the first place. But, you know,
no,
still,
neither
very
do I.
Good. Very good. If a play comes up where they need a Clive Tyldesley.
Those words are just forever etched into my mind from the 1999 season. His commentary was just absolutely exceptional. I love his voice. And the way he commentates football matches. He's been my favourite ever since I was a young boy. Yeah. And I was gutted when ITV lost the Champions League coverage.
Yeah, I know. Did it go to Sky then BT, or did it go straight to BT?
It went to Sky for like a season or two, and then BT. And he's always stuck with ITV, hasn't he? I bet he's had offers to get over to BT Sport.
Oh, he must have. Well, I mean, the man we're talking about is one of the most famous voices in, well, sport, arguably, not just football, Clive Tyldesley. He's going to join us on the podcast very shortly. But the man's worked for ITV, working on European football, covered multiple European championships and World Cups for England. And as soon as he arrives, you're going to recognise his voice immediately. It's so surreal following. He joined Instagram earlier at the back end of last year, and following on there is just strange seeing him in person and...
Yeah, it's a very, very exciting guest. And obviously for you, Rich, is he someone that you'd like to emulate in your commentating career? Is commentating the main thing you want to do? I know you've had your recent spell on Radio X and kind of working your way up to presenting the main shows.
It's definitely one thing like I'd seriously consider doing. I mean, what, having a career where you get paid to watch football, it's the literal
fantastic
dream, isn't it?
Yeah.
So yeah, that's definitely up there. And I mean, the fact that he's like gone abroad, and you know, I mean, he'll tell us more about it, I'm sure. But you know, traveling with like England squads, and you know, the whole kind of like media circus around like these international events and these huge club football events as well. Like, it's just the excitement. Obviously, is the football, but then the little things that come along with it and that sort of things, like the stories within the story. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it'd be brilliant. I can't wait to talk to him. Yeah, we've got some good questions lined up, and I'm sure he's got plenty to say. Oh, Clive's joining.
So he's here, bang on time. Wouldn't expect anything less. One of the most famous voices in football, Clive Tyldesley, joins us on Triple Captain. How are you, Clive?
I'm as well as can be expected, which is pretty good in the circumstances. I'm not quite in the endangered species age category. I'm fighting fit. And I am as happy as anybody can possibly be in the UK or anywhere on the damn planet at the moment, to be honest. You know, happy enough in isolation with my good lady wife is wonderful. And our four guys who are all probably between 24 and 28. So they're all in London, and so far so good. They're well.
Brilliant. That's good to hear. I mean, you have been keeping yourself very busy. I mean, I follow you on Instagram, and you've been making a lot of videos cooking and replicating having nights out and that sort of thing with your wife. You seem to be keeping yourself pretty entertained.
I think the best kind of humour at a time like this is self-effacing, self-derisory, self-parody. But whenever people have asked me about my job, which is my dream job, it's the job that I always wanted to do, you know, one of my default mechanisms to play it down is to say, look, you know, we don't save lives. And I used to play in a charity golf event every year for a heart foundation. And as a G-list celebrity, got paired with, you know, three people who had actually paid to play in it. And they tended to be surgeons every year. Every year I met three different guys, and every year they'd start with the same opening gambit. God, man, I don't know how you do what you do. I said, what? You cut people open, save lives routinely, like on an hourly basis every day. I shout names out. And the people who are routinely cutting people open and saving their lives every day are doing it at a massive personal risk at the moment. And it certainly puts my job into perspective. So,
I mean, it's the same in our house, because my housemate, Ree, she's a nurse in Whitechapel in the intensive care unit. And she's coming in from like 12, 13-hour shifts. And I'm like, oh, I've got a four-hour show on the radio tonight. It's just pales in comparison to what she's got to do. But But yeah, no, I completely understand where you're coming from there. But thank you very much for joining us. This podcast is mostly about fantasy football. Luke is one of the success stories, you could say.
I remain humble.
Are you top half of the table? Is that success amongst your group?
Yeah, I was. I'm top 50,000 this year, and I finished top 10,000 last year. So in a game with like 6.5-7 million people, I'm pretty pleased with that. But I do spend an awful lot of time on it. I'd imagine similar, but in no way the same as you in terms of poring over stats, looking how many shots strikers have in the box each week, and shots on target, and all of those things in order to try and pick my team. So I'd imagine if you did play FPL, you'd have a fantastic starting point with the masses and masses of stats and facts that you prepare for each game.
My riposte to that would normally be you need to get out more, but it's not a suitable thing to say at the moment. But when this is over, Luke, you need to get out more.
Well, I mean, I've got more time than ever because I'm an actor by trade, and like football, all our whole industry is pretty much shut down at the moment. So myself and my fiance, who's an actress as well, are just at home. So there'd be even more time if football was on to have a look. So just trying to fill that void at the moment.
I may be a bit of a purist, really, which is probably a nice way of saying I'm a bit old fashioned. The only son I've ever played FIFA with before he got so good, he didn't even want to play against me. He was probably about 2.5 at this stage, by the way. Even though he supported Esports Liverpool, actually, he was born on Merseyside and supported Liverpool all his life. Right now, he's a 24-year-old who's wondering whether he'll ever see his team win the Premier League title. Yeah. But he would immediately start transferring players that he totally loathed and hated into his team, which was still Liverpool, in order to make them better. And of course, I was now stand over his shoulder and say, you can't do that. You can't. Lionel Messi doesn't play for Liverpool. And I'm going to probably name drop throughout this, but among my good friends is Miles Jacobson, who is champ manager. A million years ago, long before any of you were born, I actually put some commentary on the early champ manager, now football manager. So I know him from way back. I always call him, I don't call him a fantasist. He's just totally delusional. Football isn't like that. You can only have what you can have.
Yeah. But just going back to the stats thing, I read John Motson's book, and as far as I'm aware, you're collating stats and records and that sort of thing. I've seen your sheets. The record that you have is all your own personal record, I'm right in saying. I mean, when I do a commentary, obviously I've only been doing it a few years, I get provided stats by the Premier League and that sort of thing. But are your stats or is it a bit of a combination of both?
Yeah, I think two things. One, I'm funny enough trying to use this time to write my book, and I have spent most of the morning writing a really, really difficult chapter about racism in football. And right. So there will be nothing about stats or charts in my book. I know and love Motti very much. But there will be nothing about stats and charts in my book if and when it ever gets commissioned and published, if I ever finish it. And the stats and charts are, you know, they're what I need. I have to have those. And I would rather get a statistic wrong that I've researched than one that's been handed to me. And then I have to go and find somebody afterwards and say, thanks, I've just said that in front of 20 million people and I've now got 20 million tweets saying you're wrong. So I suppose I keep my own records because it's my fault if they're wrong. I don't think I'm a big, I hope I'm not a big stats commentator. I keep the stats and then I try to interpret them. I rather pompously think a football commentary is a piece of journalism, really. And part of journalism, obviously, is researching the story and reporting the story. But the bigger part of journalism is editorializing the story and deciding what is important about it in order to relay it in such a way that your audience understands it. The audience is always king, always queen.
I don't know if you've been down to TalkSport International, but there's booths and booths and booths of, well, screens essentially with each Premier League game, Bundesliga games, and you know, you've got it in Arabic and in Spanish and in Mandarin and loads of different languages from around the world. But there is some commentators in there who obviously, you know, you have your players' details with the transfer fee, their contract length, that sort of thing. But then some commentators have a line that they're going to use if that player scores a goal. Do you prepare these kind of like headline lines that you're going to read out when a player scores a goal?
To an extent. Some people might almost say, oh, well, that's cheating. Well, it's not. No, there's no such thing. Anything that you can prepare in advance, which enables you to deliver a better commentary, is simply good research. People will faint at the end of the sentence that I'm about to utter, because, you know, commentators have a reputation for using and abusing the English language. I am a lover and hopefully a respecter of the English language. Without being too grand, I can use the same words that Stephen King uses, or, you know, I like elbows writing, so Guy Garvey's, I can use exactly the same vocabulary. I don't think that it necessarily would be fitting for football. There are some commentators who try to be a little bit more poetic than I would be. I don't quite get that. I think that's a bit of a performance. And I don't think you're serving your audience as a good journalist if you're looking for the great lines all the time. But if you are commentating on a game where, for instance, Harry Kane's going into it with 198 goals, I think that to prepare a couple of lines for the 200th goal, so that you're able to deliver something which is succinct and to the point, which are features of commentary that I think are really, really important. It's one thing having the stats, and he might be the first Spurs player who's done this, or whatever. But if you can then write them out in a couple of short, sharp sentences, not to deliver at the moment that the goal goes in, because for me, the grammar of commentating on a goal is to commentate the goal first and foremost, and to call it scabby or scruffy or deflected or truly breathtaking and brilliant, whatever it is. If you're working with a co-commentator, then to allow the co-commentator, and I think the actual, I suppose, what would we call it, that, you know, the numbers, the stats, the significance of the goal we've just seen, I think they come 45 seconds later when everything's settled down, when we're ready for kickoff again. I think that's when you say it's all commentary is personal. But, you know, if somebody's gone 10 games without scoring, the commentator goes, the other score with 10 games. No, I don't think it belongs there. I think the moment is a special moment because it's a goal. And, of course, at the moment, in the present day, we're never quite sure whether it's a goal or not. You know, you have to be careful of that. There's nothing – it'd be a shame to use that Harry Kane stat and then for the goal to be chalked off 30 seconds later, because when he does score his 200th goal, everybody knows what's coming. And so, you know, I think that there is a journalistic editorial process to be applied to telling the story of every part of a football match, and goals included. And if you can prepare something in advance of the possibility of a landmark being reached, which captures that landmark in two sentences rather than 15 rambled sentences, then I think it's good preparation.
Triple Captain from Sound Rebel. Please subscribe to this podcast so you never miss an episode.
You're now working for TalkSport and you're more regularly on the radio. More difficult to do that for radio, because you can't just let, you know, the footage play out, if you will, on radio, because obviously, you know, you can just see the crowd celebrating, you can see the players running around on TV. You know, you have to put that across on the radio. So is it much more difficult for you to do that, or has it just come more naturally? Because it was radio you started in, wasn't it?
Yeah, and this is my first season back in radio. The game that I commentated for TalkSport at the opening day of the season, which I think was Tottenham Aston Villa, was the first radio commentary I'd done since 1989, which, you know, was there was no electricity in 1989. It hadn't been invented. but it was a long, long time ago. I gave a lot of thought to it before TalkSport had asked me, and I sort of, can I really do this? Do I want to do this? And once both of those boxes had been ticked in my mind, I just had to show myself in the first 10 minutes that I could find that different rhythm again. And it is, commentary is a lot about rhythm, and that's what you're alluding to, really. Obviously, it's a different rhythm on radio. But the single biggest difference between a radio and a television commentator is that you're just not as important in television. And I think it's really, really important for television commentators to get his or her head around that. And again, in it might be a question of wrestling with your vanity a little bit. But in a television commentary, you are the soundtrack, you're the accompaniment. And even though there are great movie soundtracks, nobody goes to the cinema to listen to a soundtrack. They go to see the visual medium. It is a visual medium, television. And so you are secondary. The most important person in the broadcast is the man or woman who's the match director, who's calling the shots, calling the visual shots. And you have to get your head around that. And I think it's more of a, cerebral might not be the word, I think it's more of the act of a head, of concentration. Radio is far more about the heart. You plug in and go, the red light comes on, and away you go. There's certain grammar that you've got to observe. I don't think you can give the scoreline too often during a radio commentary. I don't think you should be apologetic about continually updating the scoreline, because obviously the graphic isn't there in the corner of the screen. There's nothing more frustrating about than joining a radio broadcast and not knowing the score. Mm. And yeah, there's a different flow about it, different relationship with the co-commentator. But most importantly is your relationship with your audience. As I say, the job of the broadcaster, the communicator, be it commentator, presenter, weather presenter, whatever, is to identify your audience and communicate to them in a way that they best understand the information that you're trying to give. So you've just got to adapt your style in order to serve that purpose.
So, you know, growing up in Manchester or as a Manchester United fan, do you ever get accused of being biased at all? I mean, I can kind of hear it in my commentaries. Is that something, you know, you ever struggle with?
Everybody struggles with my affiliations, and I struggle with them in a sense, because I am very, 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 very old. The Manchester United team, I'm from Bury. I should really have been a Bury fan, because I went to Gig Lane before I was born. We lived next door to the Bury manager, would you believe, when I was growing up. I mean, a 10-minute walk from the ground. Stadium would have been overdoing it a bit. And my mum went to see games there before I was born. So, but my dad was a United fan. I mean, Bury's only 10 miles from the centre of Manchester, and he was actually born and raised a little bit closer still. Crosby Babes in the 50s, you know, was probably, let's see, he was in his, whatever, late 20s, early 30s then. So he took me to United when I was about five, and I was home and away for a spell. They actually had a season in what's now the Championship, 74, 75. I think I missed about five games home and away that season. You know, it was probably my second year at uni. Had a car and could go to the games, went on a lot of football specials, the train, saw a lot of hooliganism, didn't take part in any of it, but saw a lot of it. And then I got my dream job. Straight from university, I managed to get a job as a T-boy at a commercial radio station that was opening in the city where I was studying in Nottingham. You know, within 3 or 4 months, I was the Nottingham Forest reporter stroke commentator. And I was spending a lot of my life, A, inside track, where I'd always wanted to be, inside a football club. Brian Clough was the manager. You know, my first big friend in football was Martin O'Neill, still is one of my closest friends in football, say, same sort of age as these guys. So I used to travel with them on the team coach or the team train to games, spend most of my week waiting for interviews down at the stadium. And then after matches, we'd go out together in Nottingham. So suddenly I was commentating on my mates. And I mean, believe it or not, the Manchester United thing just left me. It just went away. And to this day, I would have to say I have never commentated on any game or watched any game of football where I didn't want one team or the other to win. I think that is automatic. It may be the lesser of two evils sometimes. But I defy anybody who really cares about football to sit down in front of any football match and, I don't really mind who wins this. You do. You always mind. But now my allegiances are steered by the people that I'm fortunate enough to know really well in the game. You know, there's usually some association with mainly managers these days. Obviously, I don't know many players. I'm old enough to be the grandparent. Or perhaps somebody I really don't like, you know, somebody who's really unhelpful and difficult to work with. So, yeah, I mean, over the course of the years since, I suppose, I lost Manchester United in about 76, 77. And to this day, my feelings about Manchester United have been kind of professional. And it was a club that was very good to me, as you suggest. I was fortunate enough my first season as ITV's senior commentator after the late, great Brian Moore retired after the World Cup finals in 98 was the treble season. So I commentated on all those games right through to the final. I think the 20-whatever million watching the final. I managed to get the goal scorers right at the end, which was good. Otherwise, we wouldn't be having this conversation today. that was the season that was my formative season. And I was fortunate enough to inherit a very good relationship with Sir Alex Ferguson, who trusted me, gave me the two biggest rollickings of my life, but trusted me. And, you know, that while he was in charge, yeah, usually I wanted them to win, but not because I was a boyhood Manchester United fan, but because they were good for me, and a United victory was usually good for me.
So what did Sir Alex say to you? What was he telling you off for?
They were both misunderstandings, mercifully. He's never apologised for either of them.
That's not his style.
No. I lived, which was good. I was allowed back into the fold within a week or so on both, because they were total misunderstandings. They're both fairly long stories. I can tell you the stories if you like, but I had one down the phone, one hairdryer down the phone, which is a little different. And I had one hairdryer in the reception of a hotel in Barcelona. Funnily enough, in 98-99, albeit it was that Manchester United played Barcelona twice in the group stage, and before the match in the Nou Camp at lunchtime on the day of the game, I got a hairdryer.
Go on. Just tell us. We don't mind if it's long, but tell us the Barcelona one.
Where do we start? Sir Alex, as I say, I inherited a very good relationship with him from Brian Moore, who was hugely respected in the game. And I was also fortunate that I worked with Jason Ferguson, one of Sir Alex's boys at Granada Television. So I actually been to the house in Wilmslow and stuff. And, you know, I was around the kind of Northwest scene, so he knew who I was. And then I took over as commentator. And on Champions League games, he used to entertain myself, Gary Newborn, who was the main interviewer, the football editor, who's not with us anymore, sadly, Jeff Farmer, who was the kind of production guy, and then the presenter with Bob Wilson and then Des Lynam. We'd have a cup of tea in the grill room at Old Trafford around about 4 o'clock, Champions League game, and he'd tell us the team, tell us what he was, not only the lineup, but what he was hoping to do, what he felt about the opposition. And it was very 21st century thinking, really. You know, Fergie's probably seen as an old school manager, but his brilliance was that he moved with the times and he managed differently during the times, because everything changed. Football changed, parenting changed, everything changed during that era. So we had this relationship, and we had a meeting planned for late lunchtime on the day in Barcelona, where myself and Bob Wilson and then Gary Newborn and Jeff Farmer were going to get taxis to the Manchester United Hotel, which was down on the Port Olympic, overlooking the harbour in Barcelona. Now, Fergie had one particularly dear contact in the newspaper business called Hugh McElvaney, one of the great writers, again, sadly lost quite recently. And McElvaney, I can call him that because I knew him well, had written in his preview on in the Sunday Times quite a detailed piece at which he suggested that Fergie was going to make one change from the previous weekend, leave Phil Neville, who was right back, Gary was playing at centre-back at the time, and leave him out and play Wes Brown, because Rivaldo on the left-hand side was very tall and strong, and he wanted a tall, strong player to play at right back against him. And I'd kind of read between the lines and figured out that this was what was going to happen. So blow me down, the evening before the game, I was in the team, I was in the hotel that ITV were using, and I got into a lift to go to bed, and Neville, the father of the pair of them, happened to get into the lift with me. And in the course of the 10 floors that we went up, he said, Phil's worried because he thinks he's going to be left out. And I said, well, I don't know, Nev, but, you know, I can tell you that if he is, it's only because Wes is taller and he wants to be. And I didn't refer, the mistake I made was I didn't say, I read this in the Sunday Times, because I didn't want to shock Hugh McElvaney. So you know what's coming. Nev went to his room, spoke to Phil, told him. Phil told Gary. Gary went down to breakfast the next morning, said to Fergie, Clive Tilsey knows the team, why don't we know? You haven't told us the team. The commentator knows the team before we do. Oh. So I walked into the hotel innocently at lunchtime to this jab in the chest. Who effing told you the team? I don't know the team. And then a big barney of 40 seconds of expletives, and I was gone. I was out of there. So it was probably another 4 or 5 days before I was able I think I actually picked the phone up and phoned him and said, look, I'm sorry, I only read Hugh McIlvany's piece in the Sunday Times. I was only guessing. And I'd already had the hairdryer then.
Triple Captain from Sound Rebel. Get in touch on email triplecaptain@soundrebel.co.uk.
Do commentators have the same kind of relationships with managers now, or was that kind of a specific for that time period?
No, I mean, the biggest single difference that I've seen in football in the 158 years that I've been in it, it is the breakdown in the relationship between football and its media. I think both sides are equally to blame. I think it's a shame, because if you take that sort of basic approach towards what we do that I always try to follow and always refer to if I'm speaking to undergraduates, the media undergraduates in a seminar at university or something, it's always to take a step back and ask yourself, what is your purpose? What are you doing? Who you're trying to serve? What you're trying to do? And in very basic terms, the media are the go-between between the game and the fans. You know, we are the fans who are given a free ticket to the best seat and some free access to the players and manager, to their press conferences, to private one-on-one sit-down interviews, and relationships hopefully build so that you can glean the information, the inside track, and take it back to the platform that you're going to deliver it to the fans. And I mean, their relationship has changed a little bit with social media and stuff, but and certainly with agents and press officers, and there are quite a few now obstacles blocking that natural flow of information between the two. But it's the trust that's broken down, and the distance that's grown between, I don't know, Paul Pogba and the football writer for the Manchester Evening News, or the radio commentator for, you know, whatever has replaced Piccadilly, but which used to be the commercial station up there. I'm going to go through the rest of my career without having any real communication with many more footballers. We keep our distances from each other, and there's a bit of a nod. I think quite a lot of them know who I am, and I obviously know who they are. And that helps if you find yourself at a charity function or build up friendships and things, and you might swap numbers. But even if you do build up a relationship, as I say, there are various middlemen and women who would rather step in and manage that relationship, and therefore the relationship isn't a proper relationship. If you imagine you and your girlfriend or boyfriend, and you always had to go through the father or something, you know, for any kind of communication or some, you know, office, then it's not a relationship, is it?
No. Is that the same when you're on international duty as well? Because you hear a lot of time that the media are housed almost sometimes within the same hotel as the England team. Is that the case there as well?
Well, I'm particularly fortunate, given that England has been ITV's main contract or main and longest running contract. I think I've been commentator on most England games for the best part of the last 10 years. And Gareth was our wedding. You know, I go way back with Gareth. I mean, Gareth is a mate. You know, he is one of those mates I commentated on. And Roy Hodgson was a really close friend too. And Gary Neville was part of that setup. You know, I know Steve, Gareth's assistant, pretty well from Chelsea days and stuff. So I've got an unusual relationship with the England camp. It's almost like it's the kind of relationship that I used to have, I suppose. Well, even more so than with Alec. I mean, Gareth will trust me, you know, with information, because he thinks he sees some value in the commentator having some insight into what he's trying to do, to clearly trust that commentator to relay it. But, I mean, ticking into stoppage time in Nice with Iceland leading by 2-1, I had to utter the words, and you know, this will make Roy Hodgson's position untenable. He's a friend, he's fascinating company, really, really great, earnest guy. And listen, he'd resigned almost before I'd said it. He knew, so I wasn't calling for his head as such in a tabloid kind of way. But it's not an easy thing to do when you're speaking to 20 odd million people and saying that it's about time my mate stood down.
Yeah, how difficult is it to put into the words when you're watching those horrific moments. Like, obviously, when the great elation of, you know, a team, an English team winning the Champions League final or something, do they come easier?
Yeah, I think it is a little bit more difficult when you have that personal investment, when you know the wife, when you know the family, when you know the guy and how much he cares, and he's taking you into his confidence before the game and explaining what he was wanting to try to do, and none of it's happened. I mean, England's, I'm sure this is out there publicly somewhere, England spent the best part of an hour the day before the game on defending throw-ins before that game. I mean, you know, Roy, Ray and Gary. And the two people that had the most important roles in combating that major Icelandic threat, remember England had taken the lead with a slightly dodgy penalty after 4 minutes, couldn't have had a better start. It meant Iceland had to come out of their shell, really couldn't have gone any better. And the very first throw-in, those two people, one, here's a bit of a giveaway, who was the senior player in the team, and the other, who'd been the best performer in the tournament up until that point, neither of them did their jobs. You know, I saw some footage recently of Graham Taylor during that infamous film that he made, where he is just looking helplessly. And, you know, we've all had similar situations in our life where, where did it come from? What movie? You had one job, you know, got that great line. And, you know, literally, these are human beings. And the last thing that would have been said to them before they went out was, A, don't concede a throw-in, and B, if you do, you know what you're doing, you. All you've got to do is get touch tight. Just be physical with him. Just don't let him get a clear jump. And you, track the runner. The distance between the guy who was supposed to be touch tight when he came in is about a meter. He wasn't touching him. And the guy who was supposed to track the runner stood still. And I guess you look at each other and you think, well, it's the last 24 hours happened. You know, did we do any of this? We did. Yeah. We did tell them, didn't we? And it's the nature of the beast. You're dealing with human beings.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, I'm an Everton fan, but all my friends, I think, would never speak to me again if I didn't ask you about the 2005 Champions League final. What was it like in Istanbul? You were there straight after the final, or the whole kind of build-up around the final. What was it like seeing thousands of Liverpool fans descend into Turkey?
I guess it's the strangest big match that I've ever done. Liverpool played far better 2 years later, far better. I remember watching, they played, for people who were not aware, they played the same opponents, Milan, 2 years later in the final and lost. And I obviously watched the 05 final back in its entirety as part of my prep for 07. And it was only when I watched it back that I was reminded that they were the only 6 minutes that Liverpool had in the entire game. It didn't turn the tide of the game. They scored three times inside 6 minutes. But Milan kind of brushed themselves down and just continued to dominate the rest of the match, both into extra time too. It was a checkered Liverpool performance. I mean, this is slightly controversial, but there probably should have only been about five winners' medals struck, because there were five brilliant performances which carried the rest of the team, which really didn't play very well. Rafa, bless him, was, you know, credited with masterminding the thing, and Guillaume Balague did a very honest book with him, in which it was revealed there was total carnage in the dressing room at half time. Rafa gave two team talks, one with 10 counters on the board, one with 12. he was bringing off Traore, and then Finnan was unwell, and so Didi Hamann went out to warm up and didn't know who was coming off. So, the masterstroke of putting Harman, who should have been in the team at the start, let's face it, was in itself slightly chaotic. It's football, you know. It's the greatest post-match interview ever given, Fergie, 99, football, bloody hell. You know, don't ask me. Don't ask me how we won. We won. Roy, who I've just mentioned, Roy Hodgson, who's a great thinker on football, often said, you know, football is analysed from the final whistle back to the first whistle. It's played the other way. And if, you know, the king of excuses, whoever that may be, Mourinho may be, Mourinho is a master of getting to the end of a 1-1 game and referring to a penalty they should have had in the third minute and saying basically, there, we won 2-1. Well, no, because if you've been awarded the penalty in the third minute, the rest The other 87 minutes would have been totally different. We all sit in judgment with the great wisdom of hindsight and look back from the final whistle. Arguably the biggest game I ever covered, and remember I was in local radio in Merseyside from 77 through to 89, you know, through all of those victories, through Heysel, through Hillsborough. And the 86 FA Cup final between Everton and Liverpool, I mean, I knew all the guys. They were all my mates playing against each other for what was actually the biggest prize in football at the time. The FA Cup final was a bigger event even than the Champions League final. Everton had been favourites to win the title right up until the last two games and let it slip through. They were defending champions, let it slip through their fingers. And so their chance of, you know, some kind of redemption was to beat Liverpool in this massive event at Wembley, where tickets were just absolutely impossible to get hold of. It was the derby to end all derbies. Okay, it happened again 3 years later, but at the time, we felt it was the biggest game that could possibly be. Everton took the lead, should really have been two up, and Liverpool came back and won three. And what I'm coming around to saying is probably my best mate in the Everton team at the time was the right back, Gary Stevens. And Gary, at 1-0 up, played a ball down the field. It went into the Liverpool half of the field. It was a poor pass. It was misplaced. But it was picked up inside the Liverpool half of the field. You will find Evertonians to this day who blame Gary Stevens for that defeat. Now, wait a minute. Yeah. You know, Everton had, I don't know, at least eight or nine men goal side when Mulby picked it up. And plus the fact that was 1-1. You know, it was 1-1 in a game that Everton, which Everton were on top. But I don't know. Somehow my business has turned us all into pundits and analysts and strategic know-it-alls of football where, it all goes back to when that throw-in and that when he gave the ball away. No, it doesn't. Football doesn't work like that. Football's about rebounds and ricochets and strange bounces. And, you know, that's very often how the great games are won and lost. And I sometimes think, I'm a great believer that footballers win and lose football matches, not managers. The manager has a big influence, but they don't kick the ball. Mm. And somehow, again, my profession attaches this massive significance to the role of the manager, to the point where when the players mess up, he or she's the one that goes. And I'm not sure that it's relative to it. It's actually easier to get rid of the manager than it is to replace 15 overpaid players, I guess. But we do all have this kind of wisdom after the event, which it takes a bit of the fun out of football. I think when you play football, you know that it's not like that. You know, if you have a five-a-side match and it finishes 13-12, you don't think back to the, we were 4-1 up when you gave the ball away and that got them back to 4-2. You don't think like that. And yet we analyse football like that. Stupid.
Triple Captain from Sound Rebel. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, please leave us a review to help more people discover us.
So I've only got one more question. I don't know if you two have got any more questions for Clive.
I've got a question, and it looks like Luke's connection has just gone, so I'll jump in and take the opportunity. Hi, Clive. I'm Ben, the producer. I'm a massive Villa fan who's always loved Gareth Southgate, loved him even more when he became England manager. I didn't realise that you had such a personal relationship with him. Is he the man that I hope he is?
Absolutely. And I made that point even without the question. This is not a PR stunt. He is that man. I commentated on a game towards the end of his time in charge of Middlesbrough. And I went up the morning of the game and went and saw him in the dressing room probably about 4 o'clock. And he was under pressure. And he looked, this is a strange thing to say at the moment, but he looked as if he was about to die. He was grey, gaunt. All the cheer had gone out of him. And football management, honestly, you see them 3 weeks after they've been sacked. And it's like somebody's just peeled 10 years off their lives. And I didn't think Gareth would ever manage at that level again because I thought he was almost too smart to do that. And he was going to be, strangely, he was going to be co-commentator with me for the World Cup in Brazil. But we lost a pundit a couple of days, I think, before the tournament. And he was called into the studio. Not Brazil. Where was it? South Africa. Beg your pardon, South Africa. Because I did the games with Chris Coleman in there, which was great because Cookie's a big friend too. And I bumped into Gareth in Brazil where he was scouting. He was one of the England scouts who was going. I guess he might have been under 21 coach, and maybe he had that kind of director of football role. But he was one of Roy's team out there, and I bumped into him in a hotel, and we went to the same game together. I remember it was in Fortaleza, and came back to the hotel to watch the first England game together. And I could never have imagined then that my mate would finish up with a big job, because I thought he was happy doing a bit of telly, looking after the development of the, and of course he was almost frog marched into the job when another pal, funny enough, Sam, messed up, and I don't think he particularly wanted it then, but boy, he's a very light-hearted, funny guy, but very bright and intelligent, but very, very earnest and studious. And so anything that he takes on, with a real seriousness. I could say exactly the same about Gary Neville, by the way. So very impressed by their thoroughness, their professionalism, their commitment to be the very best they can be, or whatever they are. And like I say, I loved Roy and still love Roy, but Gareth moved this whole thing on at the 21st century, looked at other sports, looked into the psychology aspect, the mental aspects. He's got a fantastic relationship with the players. I remember saying before they went to the World Cup, they played a friendly at Leeds. Was it against Costa Rica, I think? And it wasn't a great night, but I remember saying at the final whistle, this will be a very easy team to support this summer. No egos, no rifts between players, just mainly young guys who wear the shirt with some pride, and Gareth had instilled all that in them. And, you know, the World Cup adventure was a strange one, because had Harry not scored that winning goal in the last minute of the opening game we were expected to win, we'd have been back really where we were 2 years earlier when Russia equalised in the last minute against Roy's team. Roy's team played really well that first night, should have won, and drew 1-1, and suddenly the pressure's on you. I mean, with the second game we played the dog and duck, really. I mean, you know, us guys could have put a team together which would have given us a chance of winning the second game. But it meant that they went into the Belgian match under no pressure, could rest a few. And on it went from there, you know. They got stronger and stronger, played really well against Sweden. Okay, got through the previous round on pens, and actually had chances to win the final. Yeah, semi-final, I should say, reached the final. So, but at no stage in my conversations with him afterwards, he didn't come away from that World Cup believing that England were one of the best four teams in the world. He didn't. He was far more realistic than that. He knows, you know, and I say we do share private thoughts. So he is realistic, he's intelligent, and hugely committed. And we just couldn't be in better hands. He's a great credit to that. Yeah, because he did learn a lot of that in his time at Villa Park. Really did.
Well, I have to say, I'm delighted to hear it. You talk about the 21st century game. And I suppose in that game, managers can sometimes find it difficult to hold on to a job. A couple of bad performances can mean that you get the sack. Is the England job one of the last jobs where actually a manager will be given time to improve if results aren't necessarily what you'd hope that they'd be? And if so, is Gareth going to be given that chance?
Well, I think club management is 24/7. I mean, I've been trying to write a little bit recently, and I spent quite a lot of time around Brian Clough. It was my first job was in local radio in Nottingham, as you know. And I sort of asked the rhetorical question during the chapter, could he have been a successful manager today? And, I think with the great players and the great managers of yesteryear, they would probably find a way, you know, certainly somebody like George Best with the talent that he had, that you know, he would have been a great player today. I'm not sure Cluffy could have handled this today. You know, he had obviously a drink problem, which is public and stuff. But I think that he would have found the relationship different now and the sheer commitment. I don't think that people like Jurgen Klopp and Pep Guardiola knock off at all. And even though it's wrong that managers are sacked as frequently as they are, I think the successful ones, I'm a little surprised that Klopp has renewed his contract. I look at him with huge amount of admiration and a fantastic match for Liverpool. But I wonder whether somebody like that can give more than 3 or 4 years of their life with that intensity, without taking a break, without just taking a rest from it, coming out, which Guardiola did briefly on a couple of occasions. I think they almost need that. The England job is different. I mean, Gareth goes into Burton most days. He does oversee the junior teams, and there are various other aspects in the job, and he's very well suited to all of that, to the desk part of the job, as well as being a coach, and well as man managing the talents when they come together, and you have a little Sterling Gomez bust up, and you've got to deal with all that, and you've got to deal with the media and everything. And he's brilliant at all that. But, you know, would he get itchy feet if Luke wakes up Manchester United come knocking on his door? I don't know. I kind of hope not, because I think he's well suited to the England job, but it's going to be difficult to take it on from World Cup semi-finalists and Nations League finalists. I mean, we all know what will happen if we have a poor championship when and if it ever happens next year in England. You know, there'll be a huge amount of scrutiny, and I don't like the word pressure, but pressure on him. I feel as if any manager that's in a position to control their future and when they move on, they should probably try to take that opportunity while they're on top of their game. And maybe he should go while he's, while not now, but I mean, maybe he should review his career map and try to keep control of it. I'm absolutely certain he'll be in charge of the team at the championships next year. And, the team will be a year older, and that might suit them. We've got a couple of positions which he's scratching around a little bit to find the right people, had it been this summer. Yeah, I think he is. I said Klopp's a perfect match for Liverpool. I think Gareth's a perfect match for England.
Follow Triple Captain on Twitter and Instagram at Triple Captain 3.
Luke, you're back. Have you got any questions for Clive?
Yeah, I was just interested in, obviously you say you're writing your book at the moment, which I'd imagine will be a fascinating read. And I guess you have to kind of cherry pick sections of your career and your life to write about. So, and you spoke very briefly about just finishing a difficult chapter on racism in football. So I was just wondering if you could unpack that a bit more for us in terms of why was it difficult to write, and was it your choice to write a chapter about racism in football, or was it your publisher's choice or your agent's choice? I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on the issue as a whole, because obviously it's kind of been brought back. Or maybe it never went away, just in terms of mainstream pundits, commentators discussing it. And do you think pundits and commentators are talking about it enough?
Well, it's purely my decision. I haven't reached that. I haven't got as far as agents and publishers yet. I'm just using the time really to write it. I am now speaking with an agent, but he hasn't got around to reading it yet. So he might think it's crap and it might never happen. So don't hold your breath. I'm trying to write something different in so much that, I mean, I'm not giving anything away because it may never happen. I'm trying to call each chapter. I mean, I've written Fergie, I've written Cluffy, I've written Kenny, Sir Kenneth, and I've written this chapter called Big Ron. Ron Atkinson, I worked with a lot, and certainly was a very close friend. I mean, he's still a friend. We're not in touch that much now, but I was sat next to him when he said the N-word in Monaco in 2004. He was kind of talking to me, although he was talking to himself more, really. I suppose what I've tried to do is look at his experience and almost take a different stance on racism. I mean, I was the commentator for the game in Bulgaria last year, when the game was stopped a couple of times and the England players were abused by that group of sort of severe ultras. And actually, people say, oh, that must have been really, really difficult. It wasn't, because it wasn't unexpected. It was almost, we talked at the start of this about prep. It was almost something you could prepare for, really. There were a few carefully chosen words and a little bit of background on Bulgaria's previous issues and some information on the UEFA protocol and all that kind of thing. And I covered the subject. In the midst of it all, I got a close-up of the match director, who was Bulgarian, cut up a picture of Raheem Sterling, and he was just looking a bit bewildered. The play had been stopped and Gareth had come onto the field and was taking charge of a situation which the official didn't really take charge of. And off the top of my head, with no prayer, I just said, what must he be thinking? I will never know. This will never happen to me. And that sort of has become the theme of the chapter, the need to look at racism from both sides. I am quite actively involved with Kick It Out, which gives me more insight and more experience of the issues. But I find the difficulty with the debate is it's very difficult to have it publicly because you leave yourself constantly open to saying something which will be not just necessarily misinterpreted, but I mean, we all have different levels of and different areas that we find offensive. And so as a broadcaster, just in terms of, you know, managing your career, you have to be... people talk about political correctness. I've got no problem with political correctness. Most political correctness is actually just being considerate to, you know, your fellow human being and what their sensibilities. So I don't really have a big issue with that. I think I can usually describe a situation without running the risk of truly offending anybody. You'll get the vultures on Twitter who, you know, that will always kind of try and dive in on you and catch you out. But I'm fairly confident enough in the way I think and the way I speak to be able to represent my views on the most delicate of issues. And clearly this is a delicate issue. We need to know what on earth is going through the minds of those three guys who ran to the front at Stamford Bridge when Raheem Sterling was going down to take the corner. They don't boo their own black players. What is it? What possessed them? I rather than lock them up and throw away the key, I'd rather sit them down and say, what's going through your heads? What is it with you? I think that's the only way we can get to the bottom of this. And going back to Ron, finally, in this roundabout conversation, we need to understand the source of racism. We need to understand where on earth those however many dozen young Bulgarians decided to turn up at a football stadium and make monkey noises. Guys, strangers, people they've never met in their lives, same age. Where's the source of this? Because until we can get to the source of it, you know, where this word came from Ron's head, then it's just going to carry on happening and we're just going to keep sanctioning against it and legislating against it, all of which is necessary. I'm not saying it's not necessary to punish people because they're breaking the law, but we need a better understanding of it somehow.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And obviously the issue's so much more complex than meets the eye. I wonder if there's an unconscious bias at times as well, because I'm half Iranian, but obviously I'm white and I haven't experienced anything like black footballers have, but I have had a taste of it. And for me, it's the why that I'm interested in.
I'm just frightened that we're becoming terrified of debate because we're terrified of what to say. I'm not sure that the conversation that you and I are having, Luke, right now, I could have on TalkSport with any confidence, for instance, being broadcast nationally. I mean, I guess you guys will put this out. You're entitled to do so. But it's sensitive. But the way to deal with sensitive subjects is with sensitivity. Not by saying, that's what he said. We know what he is. Out you go. Which actually, if this was broadcast nationally, could happen to me right now.
Yeah, it's crazy. And you haven't said anything at all that...
Taken out of context, there are probably 15 sentences that I said in the last 10 minutes. You could stick under a Mail Online headline and my career would be over.
And we can only thank you for being so honest. And I'll be fascinated to read the book. I'm sure it will be published. But just going back to football, who would you say is the greatest footballer you've ever seen play live?
I don't know. I mean, if you know, your team, 99, that game that I did, the best player in that team was Peter Schmeichel.
Wow.
He would be the only player in that team who you could say was, I think, the best in the world at what he did. And so how do you compare him with a forward or Keno? Or you can't. So I don't really, I mean, everybody's doing... You know, best 11s. It's probably where we started, really. I don't really do fantasy football. My hero, you know, the age that I was Dennis Law. But he was, I mean, George Best was a better player. Dennis just, he had that chemistry with me as a young fan. You know, it was almost the way he celebrated, the way he played. And unfortunately, I've met him, you know, and kind of know him. So that's cool when you meet people and that, like we're talking about with Gareth, and they are what you'd hope they'd be. You get disappointed inevitably, occasionally, but you know, some of the finest people I know, let alone, I mean, you know, Doug Leash just was the most adult on the planet for 2-3 weeks after the Hillsborough tragedy. He's not trained. He wasn't trained to do anything that he did, but he knew what to do. And he's got the most childish sense of humor of any adult I've ever met. And yet he knew what to do. He had, you know, it is the biggest myth about football is that footballers are thick. They're not. They don't have degrees, but they're bright and clever, smart. You know, the finest minds wouldn't last 5 minutes in a Premier League dressing room. They just get eaten up, you know, by the level of bants that you'd need to be in.
I've only got one more question. So obviously you've just really started at TalkSport, and obviously you're going to spend many happy years there, I imagine. But what's next for you in your career? Because obviously, you know, you've gone abroad, you've done England at international tournaments, you've done Champions League finals, that sort of thing. What's your goal in your commentary career now?
Well, it's a bit grim, but it's to survive. I'm not accusing anybody of ageism, but I certainly have a challenge to combat a move towards bringing in younger people to broadcast essentially to you. And my argument with that is that the word is broadcasting abroad. And in terms of my career, I think it is possible to communicate across the generations. It's absolutely essential when your audience is 20-odd million for an England game. You can't, you've got to be able to communicate. You've got to take everybody into account. I'm one of the very oldest commentators out there. I think I'm the only commentator who commentates both in yards and meters. Not because I'm trying to be down with the kids or anything, but because I think the audience is probably split now in how they measure distance. So I'm trying to serve them both. I fudge it a bit and you get a bit of both. The 18-yard box will always be the 18-yard box. But a shot can come from 25 metres. Of course it can. There are commentators half my age who are not thinking in those terms. And I think as long as I can continue to look outside my own little world and my own little box and be across the way that my particular medium is developing, then hopefully I can continue to do exactly what I'm doing for quite a while yet. But, you know, over and beyond what I have been doing before the pandemic came, I've got no great ambitions to rule the world. It'd be nice to get the book out there in one piece, and I am actually trying to write some fiction, some drama, but yeah, I mean, they, you know, they will come as long as I can continue to do the job that I'm doing.
Brilliant. Well, I love hearing your voice, Clive, so you know, long may your reign continue.
Clive Tilsley, thank you for being a guest on Triple Captain. If you haven't already, then please subscribe to this podcast. It's obviously completely free, and we've got loads more great guests lined up whilst there's no football on. So, yeah, subscribe, please. And Clive, thanks again. We really appreciate your time. What a pleasure to talk to you.
Okay, you take care, guys.
Discover more shows on the Sound Rebel Network.
Like the Big Pod Quiz, a pub quiz in podcast form. God, I love Clive Tilsley. Can't believe we got him on.
Hi there, guys. My name is Charlie, and I am the host of the Big Pod Quiz. We are releasing an episode of Pod Quiz for you every day, Monday to Saturday, during the coronavirus crisis. Whether you are stuck inside, self-isolating, or still managing to get out into the real world, we will be providing you with a daily dose of Pod Quiz. And the highest scorers from each day will get a shout-out on the following day's episode. So please subscribe to the Big Pod Quiz now on your chosen podcast app so you never miss a round.
The Big Pod Quiz from Sound Rebel. Listen now on your chosen podcast app.